It's Monday, January 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, Iran's crippling economic sanctions are lifted. Taiwan and China feel a seismic political shift. Also ahead.
We're coming off of the best sales year ever for American vehicles, ever, in 2015.
The Detroit Auto Show has much to show off and celebrate. Janet Jackson is okay. Really? It's all on today's International Edition. Several Americans freed by Iran as part of a prisoner swap with the United States have arrived in Germany after leaving Tehran Sunday. A plane carrying three landed in Germany, where the men are receiving medical treatment at a U.S. military hospital. The release of four American prisoners was announced Saturday, just hours before Iranian and Western diplomats in Vienna announced implementation of a nuclear pact between Western powers and Iran. All of this is resonating right here in Washington as VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman joins us in the studio for discussion.
On a weekend that would otherwise be somewhat quiet, there have indeed been some developments concerning the United States and Iran. Some have to do with the nuclear accord that was reached last year, but others have to do with sort of side issues that have been festering between Washington and Tehran. I think the biggest immediate news, or the news that everyone's focused on right now, is the release of several U.S. prisoners that had been held for anywhere from a year to several years. President Obama, this is a very rare thing for him on a Sunday, but he came out in front of the cameras to make a statement about the release and to confirm that indeed there are some Iranian actors that are being given clemency in return for this. But I think that the larger picture in terms of the longer view of things has to do with this nuclear accord. There was a lot of criticism of it as to whether it would work, whether Iran would live up to its side of the bargain. It does appear that Iran has taken the initial steps that were required of it. The United States is satisfied with that, and the IAEA is satisfied with that, and the other P5 partners, that Iran has indeed shut down a large number of centrifuges. It has indeed shipped out almost all of its enriched atomic materials. In exchange for this, President Obama said that Iran is entitled to the sanctions relief that was promised. And this will be a windfall of tens of billions of dollars for Iran.
Well, the Republicans are certainly not overjoyed by the developments and feel that, in at least their argument, the Iranians have now access to money to fund terrorism, which may or may not be true.
Presumably, if they had nefarious designs, they could use those funds to boost those nefarious designs. I think it's worth pointing out that a lot of the criticism has to do with elements that aren't included in the deal, but a lot of people thought should have been included in the deal. And there was this general sense that if Iran was going to be brought into the League of Respectable Nations, that Iran should start acting like it. And of course, conducting multiple missile tests in violation of UN Security Council resolutions, picking up U.S. sailors, even though those sailors apparently had strayed into Iranian territorial waters, and just the overall level of belligerence and rhetoric, heated rhetoric that we have heard coming out of Tehran over recent months. I think from the sort of optics of it, it did seem to give ammunition to the critics of the president.
It's tough for, I'm sure, some members to look at the balance sheet and see these positive things that have happened. And then they look at the other side and they say, well, I still see people chanting death to America. I don't like it. My constituents don't like it. And if I vote for anything, Iran, I'm going to get myself in trouble.
Even the biggest backers of the deal in Congress, the most vociferous backers of the deal in Congress, will say that they don't trust Iran at all. And if you take the administration at its word, what has been accomplished will extend the breakout time, which is the time that if Iran dashed for a bomb, from a matter of months to maybe about a year. And so you have to, and it's largely a judgment call. Is 1 year of breakout time enough? I do have to say that the Obama administration has put a huge amount of its prestige and its sort of legacy on the line with this deal. I suspect that for President Obama and Secretary of State Kerry, there has to be a certain amount of unease knowing that your legacy depends so much on the will and the trustworthiness of a regime in Tehran that nobody trusts.
Well, whether or not members of Congress are going to trust Iran, we always trust the wise observations of our Senate correspondent, Michael Bowman. Mike, thanks for stopping by today.
Thank you, Jim.
Well, turning to our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee, she's also here in Studio 22 to tell us what presidential contenders are saying about the Iran deal. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim. Like Michael says, Sundays are usually our quiet days, but not today. Presidential hopefuls had a lot to say, from the water crisis in Flint, Michigan, to criticizing other contenders in their own parties. Donald Trump called Ted Cruz a nasty guy, and Bernie Sanders defended his tax plan as being completely different from that of Hillary Clinton's. He actually argued she does not have a plan, but just an idea. But I digress. Let's start with a segment by focusing on where Michael left off.
Okay, that sounds good. So where can we go to find out the general sentiments to the Iran deal on Twitter?
Well, I would say this week ABC and Face the Nation are both doing pretty good jobs at painting the general picture. The handles are the same as the account names without any underscores. So let's check out some of the tweets. Here's one. Hillary Clinton calls release of prisoners from Iran the kind of smart diplomacy I was proud to be part of in the Obama administration. So you can tell she's welcoming the news to a certain extent, but also not without mentioning her own involvement or contribution. The GOP contenders express a less enthusiastic response in general. Here's what Ted Cruz said. Any nation that captures our soldiers should face serious repercussions. A lesser-known presidential hopeful, John Kasich, said, I am thrilled for the families that the hostages were released, but where is a great victory here? Kasich is a governor of Ohio. Now let's check out a couple of more scathing remarks. Marco Rubio said, if you take an American hostage, Barack Obama will cut a deal with you. Donald Trump sent out this tweet. In Iran deal, we get four prisoners. They get $150 billion, seven most wanted, and many off watch lists. That got retweeted more than 3,500 times and liked by almost 7,000 users.
Wow. Well, what are some of the other things to watch for?
Well, the Democratic Party's debate begins in about 3 hours, and Bernie Sanders appeared on a panel to discuss the legacy of civil rights activist Martin Luther King Jr. That's all for me today, Jim.
Well, we look forward to that, and thank you for the heads up, G. You can follow her on Twitter. At G. Abby Lee, and also, of course, on our programs account. That's at VOA underscore IE. I'm out there as well at VOA Stevenson. This is VOA.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. Many Taiwanese are celebrating Tsai Ing-wen, the island's first female president. Her victory was a crushing defeat to the Nationalist Party, the KMT, and its close relations with China. But Tsai Ing-wen's independence-leaning Democratic Progressive Party victory in the legislature for the first time could have a big impact on economic and other policies with China. Tsai says the vote was a statement of the will of the Taiwanese people as a democratic country. But on the streets of the capital, Chinese seem concerned about Taiwan's new leader hurting relations between the two countries. We turn to Bill Sharp, Taiwan Fellow at the Institute of Taiwan History at Academia of Sinica, to learn more about this major political shift in Taiwan.
Well, I think Tsai Ing-wen's campaign was basically, I'll call it a domestic campaign, how to rebuild the economy, how to create some sort of positive view of the future for those folks, especially younger people, college graduates who just couldn't find jobs. And when they found jobs, the pay was rather poor. How to reinvigorate Taiwan's hollowed-out economy, which has become too dependent on the mainland. What I'll call rice bowl issues, the cost of living, the cost of buying a house, the cost of energy, all these things, issues that I call them in Taiwan's parlance, political parlance, they call rice bowl issues. Here we might call them bread and butter issues.
Well, moving forward, it is a big shift politically. What's next for the KMT, the party that has lost in this election?
I think that the KMT is at a very important juncture here. I think that, you know, typically the DPP has been called a party that was bifurcated, that lacked organization. And I think that's exactly what we see in the KMT right now. It's deeply divided. There is even some suggestion that it might split. I don't really think that's going to happen, but there are definitely different factions within the party that don't get along well. There needs to be someone who can bridge the gap.
Were Kai Si, one of the student organizers at Tiananmen in 1989, won a seat in the legislature. How is that going to play out with mainland China, do you think?
That's very interesting, Wu Kaixi. It's going to be very interesting to see how he carries his role in the Li Fangyuan, the legislature. I'm sure that the mainland is going to find that embarrassing. But we'll just have to wait and see. You know, he could turn out to be a great legislator. Another very interesting person that got elected was Freddie Lim, who's a rock star, right? But he's also was head of the human rights advocacy organization in Taiwan for some time. And listen to him speak. He seems like a pretty focused person. He could turn out to be a great legislator.
President Ma Ying-jeou had worked hard to create a lot of economic ties with China. He inked a lot of deals with the mainland. Where does China stand now in its relationship with Taiwan as it moves forward with the DPP?
Well, I think that China needs to be very circumspect and not get too nervous about this. I don't think that they want to try hardball, heavy-handed politics to pressure the DPP, because every time that they do that kind of thing, they lose. And that is, they by trying to intimidate Taiwan or pressure Taiwan, they will only build or increase the growing sense of Taiwan identity. And that is certainly not useful for them if they one day want to unify with Taiwan. If they want to win the hearts and minds of those folks in Taiwan, they do not want to deepen the sense of Taiwan identity. I think if you listen to Tsai Ing-wen's speeches, she wants to maintain the status quo. Now, what is the status quo? Well, most people would say it is maintain this relationship with China, and nothing in her campaign has said anything about independence. She knows that if she does that, she will only incur problems with Beijing and Washington and perhaps the rest of the region in which Taiwan is located.
Bill Sharp, thank you so much for joining us. Bill is a Taiwan Fellow at the Institute of Taiwan History, Academia of Sinica. Thank you so much, Bill, for your time.
Thank you. You have a good day now.
Tsai Ing-wen will assume office May 20th, and the new legislature will be holding its first session in early February. When President Barack Obama visits the 2016 North American International Auto Show this week, he's not going to be looking to replace his presidential limousine, but instead see the results of a dramatic revitalization of the U.S. auto industry. It's an amazing transformation, some say his administration can take credit for. As VOA's Kane Faribault reports from Detroit, Michigan, his first visit to the auto show comes after a record-breaking year for U.S. automakers.
Among the glitz and glamour and shiny metal and chrome on the auto show floor at Kobo Center this year, it's easy to forget how close the U.S. auto industry came to complete collapse.
When I was here in 2008, even 2009, there was just a sense of depression.
General Motors and Chrysler, Two of the big three U.S. automakers were on the verge of bankruptcy because of an economic downturn that forced many Americans to skip new vehicle purchases. Assembly lines halted, and thousands of workers like Frank Warren were laid off.
The event that led to my latest round of layoffs was a bunch of bad decisions being made by a bunch of executives overpaid themselves.
The plan to stop the meltdown was for the U.S. government to finance loans to the struggling U.S. automakers. Government assistance saved Matt Slade's job at General Motors.
They kept thousands of people, especially in Michigan and the Metro Detroit area, working. It's not the perfect scenario. However, it did save our industry.
Fast forward to 2015.
We're coming off of the best sales year ever for American vehicles, ever, in 2015.
University of Michigan law professor John Pato specializes in bankruptcy law. He says President Obama deserves some credit for saving the U.S. auto industry.
President Bush started it, and President Obama took it and ran with it. And I do think they get credit because I think there was a very significant possibility. Certainly some people were advising that you should just let the car companies fail and let them go their own way.
Today, the auto industry is much more lean. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Detroit.
And there's much more to this story. It comes with video, and you can see it at our website at voanews.com. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops. So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Well, one artist who has words of her own is singer Janet Jackson. She is denying reports that she had to cancel some dates on her Unbreakable tour because she had throat cancer. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about the story and Jackson's latest album.
Back in October, late October, she announced that she had to cancel or postpone. She was postponing dates in Kansas City and in St. Louis. And then we started to hear some talk about her having some problems with her voice. And this is not unusual. A lot of artists, when they go out on tour, overextend themselves, and then they end up with injuries to their vocal cords. So the first assumption was that's what was going on. But then all of a sudden, we started to hear rumors that perhaps she was suffering or had been diagnosed with throat cancer. And that caused, obviously, a lot of panic among Janet Jackson fans and then a lot of discussion about why she was not, she had not come forward with this information. Now, we do know that Janet is a very private person. It's very rare to hear anything about any personal about Janet. I mean, she's very open when it comes to her music, her inspiration, but her health, her family, her marriage, we know nothing about. But I guess the rumors had gotten so bad that she had to come out and say that no, she is not suffering from throat cancer. And it had gotten so bad that there were people saying that, you know, her parents were having issue or were freaked out because they didn't want to lose another child. I mean, this rumor just it got its legs and it took off.
Well, now, also, Janet didn't help things by being somewhat cryptic in her first response. She put out a video of one of her songs as her statement. And it's, you know, we're talking about The Great Forever. Wait a minute. great forever. That's like eternity,
right?
Like heaven.
Yeah. What does that mean? Yeah, that's true. And again, I think that goes sort of toward how Janet Jackson has always been. She's always been kind of cryptic, and she always takes her time in terms of coming out and saying what it is that she really means. And maybe, and this is just speculation on my part, maybe they were not sure of what exactly was going on, and so rather than deny it before you can confirm it, if you know what I mean, she said, "Let me just hold off." Now, in her statement, she said that the doctors have given her permission to move forward with her European tour dates and that she will come back around and play the cities that she couldn't get to here in the States. So it looks like things are moving forward, which is very good for her because the album wasn't doing well. The songs weren't charting as well. And we do know nowadays in 2016, you make your money on the tour. And so she stood to lose a lot of money had this tour been canceled. Not to say that if the rumors were true, that would matter as much. But, you know, it matters.
All right. Well, what do you think? Do you have an opinion about Janet Jackson's tour, about her health, about her music? Let us know. You can tweet to Shauna. She is at VOA Lady DJ. You can also log on to our website. That's voanews.com. Don't have time to sleep, but we can dream, so think outside the box, my baby. Come on. Show me how much you are missing me. I'll read between the lines. And touch your heart.
Hard to believe. We've been listening to Janet Jackson now for almost 30 years. Wow, still sounds wonderful. Well, you've been listening to International Edition for the past half hour, and you can always find us at voanews.com. We're also out there on Twitter. Follow us at @VOA_IE. For director Tracy Carter and engineer Daryl Smith, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We thank you so much for joining us today. Come back and visit again, and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It is welcome news that Iranian officials have released Christian pastor Farshid Fathi. A convert to Christianity, Mr. Fathi had served 5 years in prison on charges related to his faith. He was reportedly the last member released of a cohort of some 60 Christians who were arrested by agents of Iran's intelligence ministry on December 26, 2010. Unfortunately, Pastor Fathi's release does not appear to be a sign of a let-up of the persecution of Christians in Iran. Human Rights Monitors report that in late December, Iranian officials in Isfahan entered the home of Christian convert Mehsam Hojati, confiscating his personal belongings, including his computer and Bible, and moved him to an unknown location where he is still in detention. There are also reports that in Shiraz, 9 Christians were arrested while attending church on December 25th. Mansour Borji, a spokesman for the Alliance of Iranian Churches, known as Hamgam, told the International Campaign for Human Rights in Iran that it has become common for security agents to arrest Christian converts in various cities when many communities celebrate Christmas. By making these arrests around this time, he said, the government hopes to intimidate converts by threatening them with heavy punishments so that they would either leave the country or stop their religious activities. The latest human rights report on the plight of religious minorities in Iran by the UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in Iran notes that close to 50 Christians remain in prison solely because of their religious beliefs. The report makes clear that other religious minorities are also targeted by the government, most particularly the Baha'is, as well as Sunnis and Shia, who challenge the regime's theological orthodoxy, Jews, Yarsanis, and Zoroastrians. When he was running for president in 2013, Hassan Rouhani promised that all religions, even religious minorities, must feel justice. That promise remains unfulfilled. the U.S. calls on Iran to keep that promise and to stop depriving its people of the fundamental right to religious freedom.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.